The podcast which you are about to hear is an account of a 1974 horror film, in particular a specific scene from it. It is all the more tragic in that the host of the podcast saw it when he was very young, and he could not have expected, nor would he have wished, to see as much of the mad and macabre as he was to see that day. Still, for him, a terrifying horror film became a favorite. His love for that film were to lead to the recording of one of the most bizarre episodes in the annals of podcast history, The Thief's Monthly Movie Loot. Hello everybody, welcome to another special episode of Thief's Monthly Movie Loot. Like I did in August in the special episode, instead of talking about the usual loot of films I've seen during the week, I'm going to talk about a specific scene from a film I love and break it apart, analyze it, and see why it works. Once again, I was brainstorming what film and what scene to talk about, and there's one scene in particular I'm dying to talk about, but since it's October, I thought it was more appropriate to do a horror scene. So the scene I'm going to analyze is Leatherface's first two kills from Tobe Hooper's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. First, for a bit of background, I saw The Texas Chainsaw Massacre a good while ago. It was one of those films that my older brother, a horror film buff, rented. I'm sure I saw it way too young, and maybe because of that, it stuck in my mind. I've seen it several times since, and I think I like it every time more. I find Hooper's crude and raw approach to be so appropriate for this film, so in your face and horrific that I just love it, and it has become my favorite horror film ever. Now, like with my previous special episode, this will be an in-depth discussion, so be warned, the film will be spoiled. If you haven't seen The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I strongly urge you to turn this off and go see it. As of now, it is streaming free on the Criterion Channel, IMDTV, Shudder, and Tubi. So brace yourselves and see it. So let's begin.
What happened was true. The most bizarre and brutal series of crimes in America. Survives. What will be left? The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. After you stop screaming, you'll start talking about it.
Just to give you a bit of a background on the film, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre follows Sally and Franklin, played by Marilyn Burns and Paul A. Partain, two siblings that travel to Texas with some friends when they receive notice that their grandfather's grave was desecrated. As it's probably known by most, in their way, they stumble upon a family of cannibals that terrorizes them. None of the performers are particularly known, but special notice should go to Gunnar Hansen, who plays Leatherface, the guy with the chainsaw that most people associate with the film and one of the focus of this episode. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre was Tobe Hooper's second film after the indie film Eggshells. Hooper had already developed a story revolving around isolation and being lost in the woods, and while working as a documentary cameraman, he also drew inspiration from the realism of documentaries and graphic news coverage. It is widely known that serial killer Ed Gein was an inspiration for the story, but co-writer Kim Henkel also mentions Elmer Wayne Henley, another serial killer, as an inspiration. Filming was a mess in terms of the environment. The house had little ventilation, the temperatures in Texas were over 100 degrees during filming, and most of the actors sustained some sort of injury at some point. Hooper is quoted as saying, "Everyone hated me by the end of the production. It just took years for them to kind of cool off." Despite being a low-budget film from a rookie director, Texas Chainsaw Massacre has become one of the most popular and influential horror films ever. Many critics panned it upon release, but most have come around to recognize and praise its merits. The film opens with a text stating that the film is based in true events, which is not true. Hooper has said that this was in response to what he saw as lies told by the government around the world, from Watergate to the Vietnam War, things that happened but the public was told that didn't. So Hooper put a spin on it by taking something that didn't happen and told the public that it did happen. What follows is probably the most intense and terrifying 83 minutes I've experienced on film. The film does take its time to set the stage, but once it kicks off, it's relentless, non-stop terror. It isn't even that gory, at least visually, but it has that ever-present sense of dread over its characters that you know from the start things won't end well for any of them. As the film begins and the group is driving around, they drive past a slaughterhouse, which Franklin remembers is where his grandfather used to sell his cattle.
What smells?
What is that stench?
Roll up the window.
Hey, that's the old slaughterhouse. That's where Grandpa used to sell his cattle. Hey, we got an uncle that works at one of those places outside of Fort Worth. Hey, you see those buildings there? That's where they kill them. They bash them in the head with a big sledgehammer.
Oh, that's awful.
It usually wouldn't kill him on the first lick. I mean, they'd start squealing and freaking out and everything, and then have to come up and bash him two or three times. And then sometimes it wouldn't kill him. I mean, they'd skin him sometimes even before they were even dead.
Oh, that's horrible. Yeah. People shouldn't kill animals for food.
Oh, well, they don't do it like that anymore. Now they got this big air gun that shoots a bolt into their skull and then retracts it. It's just boom, goes boom, and
then shoot. Bacon, I like meat. Please change the subject. Boom. That's terrible. It's still going on.
To me, this conversation, which is later brought up again, is one of the key moments in the film, since it works as some sort of foreshadowing to the fate of the group, as well as a bit of a metaphor to the film itself and its approach to the characters. The comparison between the sledgehammer method versus the air gun is supposed to take in consideration the more humane way to slaughter cattle, but there is nothing humane about what happens in the film. Tobe Hooper uses no air gun, but rather takes the sledgehammer approach with the audience and bashes our heads with its raw violence. To continue with this cattle-like approach, there is little death to the characters. Sure, there are signs of resentment and issues within Sally and Franklin, but that's about it. It doesn't matter, because they're cattle headed to the slaughter. Just by reading the opening crawl text, the one that said the film is based on real-life events, you know that nothing good will come to them. So the half hour before they meet their tormentors becomes a long 30 minutes of dread and fear, much like what would be if one were to watch the inside of a slaughterhouse. And that scene is what I want to talk about. Roughly 30 minutes into the film, two members of the group, Kirk and Pam, played by William Bale and Terry McMinn, stumble upon the house of the cannibal family. What happens next still remains one of the most intense, visceral, and terrifying moments I've experienced in a horror film. So, to analyze that scene, I'm going to talk about four things. Number one, setup or build-up.
Just believe that the indictment is only one of a series. series to be handed down as special grand jury investigation. Grave robbing in Texas is this hour's top news story. An informant led officers of the Muerto County Sheriff's Department to a cemetery just outside the small rural Texas community of Newt early this morning. Officers there discovered what appeared to be a grisly work of art, the remains of a badly decomposed body wired to a large monument. A second body was found in a ditch near the perimeter of the cemetery.
Like I said, this scene occurs 30 minutes into the film, but the half hour that precedes it serves as the perfect build-up to what will happen next. From the false and misleading crawl text to that awkward slaughterhouse anecdote, every single thing in their trip spells disaster. Even if we go back further, the whole circumstances behind their trip, the desecration of their grandfather's grave, it's never said on screen, but we can infer that the decaying body we see in the opening scene is the grandfather, which gives you an idea of the kind of crazy people we're dealing with. As the group arrives at the cemetery, a drunk old man babbles about things that happen around there that people don't talk about, which is another omen of bad things to them.
Hey, folks, let us through here. This girl's granddaddy's buried here.
Been in there the whole time, unbeknownst. Glad didn't know anything. Things happen here about they don't tell about. I see things. You see, they say it's just an old man talking. You laugh at an old man. There's them that laughs and knows better.
But more importantly, the group has two interactions with members of the cannibal family, obviously unbeknownst to them, as they are heading to their destination. First, they have a creepy encounter with a hitchhiker played by Edwin Neal, who ends up doing all kinds of weird stuff.
How did you get stuck way out here?
I was at the slaughterhouse.
I got an uncle that works at the slaughterhouse.
Hey, my brother worked there. My grandfather, too.
My family's always been in me.
My whole family of Draculas.
Hey, man, did you go in that slaughter room or whatever they call it? The place where they shoot the cattle in the head with that big air gun thing.
Oh, that gun's no good.
I was in there once with my uncle.
No way. With a sledge. See, that was better. They died better that way.
How come? I thought the gun was better.
Oh, no. With the new way people put out of jobs.
You do that?
So the guy cuts his hand, he brings back the topic of the slaughterhouse, he takes a picture of them and then burns it, and finally he ends up slicing Franklin's arm, which is when they kick him out. Most of those things go back to that slaughterhouse metaphor. You see, he shows the group pictures of the cattle from the slaughterhouse, but then he takes a picture of them, which once again can be seen as some sort of foreshadowing. Their next stop is at a gas station where they meet the cook, played by Jim Sido, and although their interaction isn't as disastrous as with the hitchhiker, he does have some words of wisdom. You don't want to go fooling around other folks' property. Some folks don't like it and they don't mind showing you. But obviously that's what they will end up doing. As they are about to leave, Sally realizes that the hitchhiker had smeared blood on the side of the van as they kick him out. Sure, she tells her friends that maybe he was trying to write something, but it always makes me think of cattle branding. The hitchhiker was marking them for the slaughter. All those little details serve to set up the stage for what will happen next. The second thing I want to talk about is set and production design. I think this is one of the most notable aspects of the film, and it is particularly evident during the scene I'm going to talk about. As Kirk and Pam are looking for gas, they approach the house of the cannibal family, and there are a lot of effective choices in terms of preparing a perfect stage for it. There's the incessant sound of what seems to be an old electric generator, we see weird and creepy stuff hanging from tree branches, and then there's the auto graveyard hidden from plain sight, which makes you wonder how many people have been there before them. There's rickety fences and rusty gates, everything to raise the hair in the back of your neck. Once they reach the house, Pam waits outside while Kirk looks inside the seemingly empty house. There's a lot of simplicity to the design of the house since we mostly see three things: a staircase to the right, an entrance to the left, and an open door in the back of the room. But that door is the one that captures your attention because it has a blood red wall with all kinds of cattle skulls hanging on it. And just as Kirk gets close to it, boom, Leatherface appears and hits Kirk in the head with a sledgehammer.
Hey, Pam!
It's worth to talk about the design of the character, or at least what we see at this moment, which is very notable. From this first abrupt appearance, the character of Leatherface hits you in the head, both literally and figuratively, with his grotesque appearance, the dirty apron, and the rotten, disfigured mask, as well as his blunt approach to killing. I mean, this is not the wisecracking Freddy Krueger or the methodical approach of Michael Myers. Leatherface presents a more in-your-face, raw approach to killing. There's nothing remotely contrived about it, just wham, like a sledgehammer. The third thing I want to talk about is Tobe Hooper's direction. You have to remember that this was only his second film, after what is essentially an independent experimental film in eggshells. So to come out with this film at that point in his career is quite something. For an up-and-coming director, Hooper's work is very confident and assured, and he shows a lot of skills handling the camera and choosing the perfect shot. In this scene specifically, there are numerous directorial choices that were very, very on point and contribute to the overall effect of the scene. For example, when Kirk and Pam get to the front porch of the house, Hooper puts the camera high, kind of as if it was stuck to the wall, and the shot looks as if it was from a security camera. Obviously, there's no cameras in this old house, but I think it helps to build that sense that they're not alone and that they might be being watched. So Kirk hesitates, but enters. He hears sounds, pig squeals coming from the back door, so he runs, trips, and finds himself face to face with Leatherface. Hooper's direction is great here because the way he cuts the camera helps to put you on Kirk's shoes. He follows him as he runs towards the door, then changes to his face as he's trying to get up. But as he looks up, the camera switches to Kirk's point of view, looking up to see Leatherface. It's a great moment because Hooper chooses to reveal his big bad guy to the audience at the same time he does to the character. In this case, Kirk, which, once again, helps to put us in the place of the victims. To me, this is one of the best bad guy reveals in horror. And then there's that metal door slam, which I think is great. At this point, the focus changes to Pam, who has been waiting outside on a bench swing. When Kirk doesn't answer, she stands up to see what's going on. Here, Hooper and company start playing an ominous music, which perfectly sets the mood and the dread, because we already saw what happened inside.
Oh,
The choice of putting the camera really close to the ground, following Pam from the back as she approaches the house, is great. I think it makes the house feel bigger and more threatening as it looms in the background as she walks in. When she enters, she stumbles upon the side room where she trips and finds all kinds of creepy shit. Going back to the set design, which was my second point, there was a lot of effort in creating one disturbingly creepy room, and they succeeded. There are chickens in cages, the floor is covered with feathers, there are human remains and bones all around the room, not only thrown around but used to build furniture and lampshades with human skin, a lot of which was inspired by what was found inside Ed Gein's house when he was arrested. As she looks around in terror, Hooper constantly cuts from her terrified face to the different objects around the room, while the music and sound ramps up in the background. This is a perfect way to heighten our senses and keeps us on the edge about what's to come. Less than a minute passes in that room, but I can tell you it feels like an eternity. There's a lot of focus on one particular bench, which you can see is made of human bones, looks very creepy, and this is the kind of thing that's not explained, but there's no need to. It just tells you the kind of people we're dealing with, and it stays in the back of your mind as the film continues. It's terrifying to find yourself trapped there because you know what awaits you. So she finally manages to stand up, and as she's fleeing, Leatherface comes out of the back door. She tries to make a run for the front door, but he grabs her and takes her to the back room. There's a very intentional choice from Hooper here, since our first shot of that back room features the infamous meat hook on the foreground, as we see Leatherface dragging Pam inside in the background. So as she struggles with him, we know what's coming and where she'll end up. Finally, as she's hung there in pain, we also see Kirk is lying dead or unconscious on the butcher's block. So we have one victim in the butcher's block and another one in the meat hook waiting, you know, to perpetuate the metaphor that these victims are just cattle. And as the camera focuses on the chainsaw, Leatherface grabs it and turns it on, and he proceeds to cut Kirk as Pam looks on. What's impressive is that you might hear this description and think, damn, this is gory as hell, but nothing is seen, not even blood at this moment. But the choices from Hooper to put the camera on one side and Pam in the mid hook on the other, while the butcher's block and Kirk are in the middle, it makes for a great scene, a great framing, very horrific, but in which most of the horror is implied or left to your imagination. One bit of trivia about the chainsaw: it was borrowed by the producer Richard Sines, and Hooper had specific instructions to return it in working condition. The fourth and final thing I want to talk about are the performances. So, even though the film didn't feature any notable star, this was the first or second film, and in most cases the only film for most of the cast members, but regardless of that, most of them are pretty solid in their roles, at least as far as what was required. For example, when Kirk, played by William Bale, is about to enter the house, I think he shows that hesitation to come inside pretty well. And after he does, and is knocked down by Leatherface, he does that twitchy thing that's something that always gets me in horror films when you see victims still twitching. But once again, it goes back to the slaughterhouse anecdote from Franklin about cattle not dying from the first hit. Then there's Pam, played by Terry McMinn, who walks in after Kirk. And the way she conveys the terror of what she finds is great, and her gagging and coughing as she sees all the bones and the human remains. Also, for the mid-hook scene, McMinn was actually held up by a nylon cord between her legs, padded with maxi pads, which was still quite painful. However, she decided to use that pain to make her performance more believable. And finally, we have Leatherface, played by Gunnar Hansen. Apparently, Hansen was given free rein to develop the character of Leatherface under Hooper's supervision, so he conceived it as mentally impaired, visited special needs schools as part of his research. Actually, many people have commended him for his performance. One of my favorite parts is when he chases Pam out of the house, and I don't know how much of this was intentional, but as Pam reaches the porch, Leatherface opens the door and engulfs her with his arms and drags her inside as she struggles, arms and legs flailing. What I like is the visual image, which is hard to transmit in a podcast, but here's this hulking beast of a man at 6'4", grabbing this seemingly frail woman at 5'5", and it's pretty much as if she was being absorbed or consumed by this creature, not a man. It's a great and terrifying thing to watch. So, those are my thoughts on that excellent scene from Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Like I said before, I think that scene perfectly sets up the table for the second and third act by establishing the kind of maniacs we're dealing with. Whatever happens next is anchored in this first encounter. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre is clearly not a film for everyone, not because of its violence, which, like I said before, might seem visually tame by the modern standards of films like Saw and Hostel, but its low-budget approach and simple plot might not be down everyone's alley. But to me, most of those traits are what makes it so effective and disturbing, and that is what a good horror film should be. Not like an airgun to the head, but like a sledgehammer. It's worth mentioning that despite how terrifying, scary, or horrific the scene and the character of Leatherface might be, I've read countless of interviews and accounts about Gunnar Hansen and how he was one of the nicest guys ever. He might not have had a stellar career, but he used to be a staple in horror conventions and very much popular among horror fans. So, thanks so much for listening to this special episode of Thief's Monthly Movie Loot. If you like this breakdown and have any thoughts to share, look me up on Twitter at ThiefCGT, ThiefCGT, or on Letterboxd as Thief12. Also, stay tuned for my next regular episode, which will come out next days. In the meantime, I'll leave you with the lovely voice of Madeline Burns and the Chainsaw Wielders.